You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting from KPCW, Park City, Utah.
Good morning and welcome to the Ides of March edition of Mountain Money. Watch your back today. We have a pretty excellent show coming up as you are filling out your NCAA brackets. Real question to me is whether not only will there be upsets caused by basketball adventures on the court, but caused by COVID.
Lot to watch, and it will be fun to see them back out on the court this year.
I'm looking forward to it. So what do we got today?
Well, this morning, NPR Marketplace reporter Jasmine Gartz joined us to talk about how the end of slavery led to two different minimum wages.
Then we'll follow up with Miles Hansen with the Utah World Trade Center, who joins us to talk about how they help Utah businesses succeed globally. We'll end the hour talking with Micah Taylor about Beauty Zone's 25th anniversary. You're listening to Mountain Money. I'm Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Allison Kulo, and we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Last week, President Biden signed the COVID relief bill, the American Rescue Plan Act, to much fanfare. The bill was passed without any Republican support, and there are elements of the bill that are somewhat controversial. But one element that was not in the bill as finally passed is perhaps the most controversial, the provision to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. That issue is not going away, however. Senator Bernie Sanders vowed, if any senator believes this is the last time they will cast a vote on whether or not to give a raise to 32 million Americans, they are sorely mistaken.
Over the next couple of weeks here on Mountain Money, we hope to explore some of the implications of the proposed minimum wage increase from very different perspectives. One element of the proposed increase that could be particularly relevant to our community is the elimination of minimum wage differential for tipped workers. A minimum wage for tipped workers that is currently $2.13 an hour. So, how did there come to be different minimum wages, and what would be the implications of eliminating that differential on the hospitality industry? What are the broader implications for low-wage workers and for the economy as a whole of the proposed increase in minimum wage? We're fortunate this morning to be joined by Jasmine Garst, whose name I hope I'm pronouncing properly, a reporter on Marketplace, a show heard weeknights here on KPCW. Jasmine, good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with some basic questions. Can you tell the audience a bit about how there came to be different minimum wage levels? How does it work, and how does it relate to the history of tipping in this country?
Sure. So it used to be a common practice among European aristocracy to tip. And in the mid-1800s, wealthy Americans visiting Europe picked up the habit, and then they would come back and use tipping to show off their status, kind of like, oh, this is how we do it in Paris. It died out in Europe because of very strong labor unions. But in the U.S., when slavery ended, some companies saw an opportunity to pay recently freed enslaved people close to nothing for their labor. And one of the most notorious cases was Pullman Railroad cars, which hired thousands of black men as porters, had them living off tips and paying for their lodging, paying for their food. It was practically free labor. As time progresses, I mean, there was a strong anti-tipping movement, but it just really got cemented into law. And like you said, I mean, this is a story about gender. I mean, tipped labor is mostly female. And we know that raising the minimum wage would disproportionately help Black and Latinx workers. And we also know that Black and Latinx workers get tipped less than their white counterparts. So this is absolutely a story about race and about women, too.
So let's take it back to when we see a minimum wage law come into play. When does that happen, and how does it relate to, how did tipped workers get left out?
Right. So it's in the 1930s. And, you know, it's interesting because it's with FDR, right? In 1938, we get a minimum wage. But he's very clear in saying that it is only for industrial workers. Tipped labor gets completely ignored. And, you know, you have to understand this was like some really, really powerful forces, lobbying forces, especially in the South. It was not in their interest to have tipped labor, which was predominantly labor of color to get any type of legislation. You know, in 1966, under mounting pressure from civil rights activists, Congress finally says employers have to pay tipped workers around half the minimum wage. That's in 1966. You know, a lot of people forget that the civil rights activism in the 60s, a lot of it is about economic justice. So this stays in place until 1996, when the minimum wage the minimum wage goes up. But there's a caveat. Employers no longer have to pay tipped workers half of the minimum wage. They can pay them $2.13. And, you know, something really pivotal here is the National Restaurant Association does a lot of campaigning and lobbying in order to get that to happen. And that's where we're at since 1996, $2.13.
As you said, the Restaurant Association was one of the kind of key drivers of keeping, at least for tip workers, that wage lower. When I think of tip workers, I do think of restaurants and bars, but what other categories are there tipped workers in?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, when you think, you know, when you go to an airport and somebody helps you carry your luggage or drives you around, a lot of times those are also tipped workers. And so it's not just the restaurant industry. I think it's also, when we're talking about this, it is important to say a lot of people associate tipped work with, well, you could make a lot of money. You know, what if you're a server at a steakhouse? The reality is most tipped workers, research shows, are not servers at steakhouses and fancy restaurants. And these tipped jobs, whether it is in restaurants, whether it's in bars, and whether it's, you know, doing luggage work at an airport, these jobs are, you know, it's poverty wages.
One of the slightly amusing things about the 1996 issue was, of course, the role of Herman Cain, who was then sort of, I think, a senior person in the Restaurant Association, which makes me wonder why it wasn't 999. But that's neither here nor there. Let me ask you a question about what has happened since 1996 in terms of, as that differential has increased. I mean, you see $2 an hour being held steady. Has there been sort of movement in Congress in the past to sort of decrease that differential and raise the tipped wage?
There has, you know, but every single time, I mean, look, labor historians and economists I've spoken to have talked about the National Restaurant Association is a very powerful lobbying association. You know, it's also, when you listen to Herman Cain talk and a lot of people testifying at that time in 1996, you hear this argument, which is what we've been hearing for the last couple of weeks as well, that if we raise the minimum wage, jobs, especially small businesses, are going to just fall apart. We're going to see a lot of job losses. You know, and we are living, we're in this moment where the pandemic has hit restaurants exceptionally hard. So there is an argument that a lot of restaurateurs are making, which is, I can't afford to pay my employee $15 an hour. There also is an argument that servers are making less tips than ever. And, you know, we have seen that the social safety net is extremely difficult and for people who are living off tips as well. But we do keep seeing this argument about this is going to lead to massive job losses. You know, the Congressional Budget Office, they said they have found that it will, you know, it could lead to some job losses, but it's also going to lift a lot of people out of poverty. And labor economists I've spoken to have told me there's actually not that much evidence that it leads to job losses.
There's been a couple of municipalities or areas that have approved a $15 minimum wage, like Seattle. What have they seen with changes in either, you know, number of those employed in the restaurant and bar industry once this put in place?
Right. I mean, look, you know, there's states that have banned the tipped minimum wage. For example, California has done that. You know, and studies have shown that there's not a significant impact. We also, what we find is that when companies raise their minimum wage, what ends up happening is that other surrounding companies are also kind of pushed to raise their minimum wage. I mean, it's not tipped labor, but, you know, you see Amazon, Target, Best Buy, they've all set their minimum wage to $15 an hour. And, you know, studies have shown that that leads other companies surrounding to have to also raise their minimum wage, because obviously workers are going to go where they get paid more. So you know, in states like California, the evidence shows that it does not lead to widespread job losses.
Yeah, as we move from sort of the specifics of the minimum tipped wage to the broader question of the $15 an hour wage, the battle lines, I think, are drawn. You sort of made reference to what labor economists say. The CBO, on the one hand, has indicated that there will be job losses on the, and also a decrease in poverty levels. What is the sort of best argument, in your view, against raising the minimum wage to $15?
Well, like I said, you know, in this pandemic, restaurants have been exceptionally hard hit. I mean, it's been quite devastating for, especially for the mom and pop restaurants, for the small chains. And, you know, I think that in some ways, it's, you know, of course, you know, if you're a mom and pop restaurant and you're suddenly, you've been closed on and off for much of the year, and someone suddenly says, look, and also you have to pay your worker $15 an hour, it comes at a really terrifying time. I mean, I think all of this has to also be wrapped up in a conversation about our social security system and about, you know, how we are helping people move forward. But I think, you know, for mom and pop restaurants, the idea comes at a very difficult time for sure.
When I think about, you know, how a restaurant would be able to implement this and what it looks like, if tipping was then eliminated and so that the restaurant was then taking or increased their prices proportionate to what someone would typically tip, that starts to bring more money into the restaurants, which I would hope then could help pay that increased minimum wage. And my co-host is smiling and laughing at me on this one.
I'm only smiling because of the complexities of the tax implications. See, what's happening now is that most of that tipped income is probably not getting taxed, right, as a practical matter. And if you roll it in, not only do you have to increase the price to compensate for the tip, you also have to increase it further if you wanted to get to net zero to compensate for the taxes that the restaurant's going to have to pay on that increment. So it's a pretty complicated question.
Absolutely. And, you know, profit margins in restaurants are already so slim. I mean, you know, everyone dreams of putting a restaurant up. And, you know, what people find out once they do is that it is actually really hard to turn a profit in a restaurant. So I think that this is a very multifaceted debate. And it's also a debate that involves more than just raising the minimum wage. You know, I mean, another part of this that really interests which is predominant. And listen, I've been a tipped waitress for many years, and sexual harassment is really predominant in this industry. It's one of the industries with the most sexual harassment issues, and you know, many people attribute that to the tipped system, in which you are depending on your income. Not even on an employer, really, on an outside entity, on customers who, you know, no one can regulate them. So I think there's a lot of facets to this. And, you know, a lot of people are hurting right now. So the response has to be multifaceted as well.
It sounds like you should have worked someplace safer, like a politician's office. but the incidence of sexual harassment by customers, talk a little bit more about that. And really, it's a matter of, like, how is it that waitresses in particular have to deal with customers with respect to maintaining their income?
Right. Well, listen, I mean, there's a process by which you can file complaints. Of course, sexual harassment is illegal in the United States, but it's so precarious. And I mean, if you make $2.13 an hour and you depend on customers for the rest, it's very likely that you're going to have to be put in situations where, you know, you're going to have to put up with certain types of behaviors or comments because you need that extra money and it's not actually coming from your employer, although technically, legally, it should, but this is very hard to enforce and there is rampant violation of this. You're actually relying on, you know, people who come in and eat. And I think that at least in my personal experience and from the people that I've interviewed, this is a rampant issue in the industry and not very, very spoken about.
I wanted to ask sort of a related question, again, outside the restaurant context. And that is, one of the arguments I've heard about a $15 minimum wage is that while it might make sense in San Francisco, where as a practical matter, people are probably being paid more than that anyway, the impact it has on Dubuque, Iowa is kind of disproportionate. Has there been any discussion of trying to tailor a minimum wage a little bit more sensitively to different cost of livings across the country?
Yes. And, you know, I think something really interesting that is happening right now is that everyone seems to be in agreement that the minimum wage does need to be raised. I mean, polls have consistently found most Americans support this. And it's become a nonpartisan issue. I mean, many Republicans have also said that it needs to be raised. The question, which goes to your question, is how, by how much, and when. And so you have, for example, Republican Senators Mitt Romney and Tom Cotton. They just introduced their own act, which would raise the wage but to $10 over the next 4 years and with a provision for better enforcement against hiring undocumented immigrants. So there are these proposals, and what is really interesting about this is it isn't falling among party lines anymore. And certainly, you know, the Republican Party certainly does not want to position itself against raising wages for working Americans. So so far the Biden administration has said it is not negotiating, and it remains committed to the $15 minimum.
So one of the things that talking about this issue, especially since it's been in the news so much recently, the perspective that I've been hearing from people who are opposed to it is along the lines of like, well, does working that job really deserve $15 an hour? Not that person or their wage, but like, does that actual job equal $15 an hour? So it goes back to people looking at the type of work that's being done and how much that is worth.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, the question of how we pay different jobs is valid. But I think really when you look at the statistics and when you look at the numbers, I mean, we're talking about poverty wages. I mean, we're talking about $2.13 plus some tips. It really isn't going to get you very far in any state. And so we're talking not about, you know, should we pay servers a CEO wage? We're talking about should we pay workers enough so that they can pay rent and pay for food? You know, I mean, we know that workers of color make a disproportionate share of workers who are severely underpaid. So I don't think it's about merit. It's about, you know, treating people humanely is what the argument is.
And there's another side to that, I think, in that so many, you read statistics about how many workers at the minimum wage are simultaneously getting government benefits like food stamps and other kinds of supplements. So in fact, What we're doing is we are subsidizing the ability of large corporations who pay minimum wages through taxpayer dollars to get their workforce. And is that really fair to the taxpayer, frankly, not to require the company to bear the burden of the cost of their labor?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think you've raised a really fascinating question here, which is how much of the industry is actually subsidized by the taxpayer. And I think, if people you know, I hear a lot of these arguments against raising the wage. I think what a lot of people are not aware of is that, you know, in essence, we are, you know, the taxpayer is kind of subsidizing a lot of these commercial ventures. And that's something that, you know, was brought up in the last couple of weeks, you know, that perhaps raising the minimum wage, one of the arguments was that raising the minimum wage would actually be a way of cutting back on a lot of social assistance programs, because suddenly you would get a labor force that is able to pay for rent and is able to pay for food. You know, I think back to the previous question about who merits what kind of salary. I think, you know, I think we can all agree that as a society, we should be paying workers enough so that they can afford their basic needs without having to go to government assistance.
I think another piece that we hear, especially in that demographic that works at that wage rate, is that they have more than one job as well. So if you were to think of moving workers to a minimum wage where you can actually live and you can, you know, match the cost of living where you're at, those families start to look at a different dynamic when the parents can be home and help the kids at school. So in some ways, there's a lot of indirect benefit if we were to move down that road.
Yeah, and beyond the minimum, beyond the tipped wage, when we're talking about minimum wage, what we also start to see is less of a turnover. You know, the restaurant industry is notorious for its high turnover. And you know, in companies that are not tipped minimum wage, they're just regular minimum wage, you start to see employee loyalty and employees really sticking around. And I think, you know, it's at this point, I think everyone is talking about, you know, the benefits of this. It's not a Democrat issue. It's not a Republican issue. I think it's pretty clear that it's something that we want as a society to change. But again, it's how much, when, and, you know, what are the caveats?
Which leads me to another question. I sort of raised the idea of possibly creating some kind of geographic distinction in minimum wage. Another question I have is there active discussion of creating categories where employers of a certain size have to pay a certain minimum wage? In other words, the one that would effectively cut the mom and pops out of or have a lower minimum wage for that. Is there discussion of that where large corporations would be subject to a larger minimum wage?
Well, you know, one of the discussions that was happening in the last couple of weeks was of, you know, possibly penalizing larger corporations that did not pay a certain wage. You know, as we know, none of this made it. But it is really interesting that actually some of the biggest corporations are the ones that have been lobbying for the minimum wage. Amazon, Target, Best Buy. They've all set their minimum wages to $15, and Amazon has actually been actively lobbying Congress to raise the federal minimum. What's interesting is that there's critics who say Amazon is trying to put its competitors out of business by forcing this cost increase that small business can't possibly absorb. I mean, It's definitely, look, I've been doing a lot of reporting with mom and pop restaurants, especially here in New York. You walk around the city and there's so much that has just gone out of business. And at times it just looks really spooky, just how many businesses have gone out. And, you know, definitely for mom and pop restaurants, there needs to be like a patchwork, it would seem, of legislation.
I have to say, you know, we're coming to the end of our interview, but you and I feel like the dialogue that we've had today has brought up so many intricacies of what this issue has and what it brings and why it's a difficult discussion. What do you expect to happen regarding this issue over the next year?
I think this issue is going to keep coming up. I mean, it did not make it into the most recent relief bill, but most Americans support this. I think it's a bipartisan issue. And I also think, you know, yes, there's a lot of discussion of how this last relief bill has been monumental and it has been groundbreaking, and this is true, but a lot of it is temporary. And, you know, what is going to happen to minimum and sub-minimum wage workers once this ends? And this conversation is going to continue. In fact, I think this will be the next big issue. And the administration, this was one of their main campaign promises. And it definitely sounds like people are going to be expecting some kind of change here.
I appreciate your time with us. We've been speaking with the senior reporter for Marketplace, Yasmin Gard, and Mountain Money will be right back after this. Welcome back to KPCW's Mountain Money. Helping you think, act, and succeed globally is the mission of the World Trade Center Utah. With over $13 billion of exports in 2015, the World Trade Center Utah succeeds in guiding Utah companies into profitable global markets. Joining us to discuss their efforts is Miles Hansen, President and CEO of the World Trade Center, Utah. Miles, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me on.
So the World Trade Center, Utah was founded in 2007. Can you explain what prompted the start of the organization and then, of course, what the organization does to build Utah's international business community?
Absolutely. So World Trade Center Utah, like you noted, Allison, was founded in 2007. At that time, John Huntsman was governor of Utah. And as he looked at Utah's economic future, he recognized a couple different things. One, he could see that Utah was positioned to excel in international business. Our comparative advantage, the thing that makes us different from the states around us, is how internationally minded we are here in the state of Utah. And so he wanted to build on that competitive advantage to help our companies go out there and compete and win around the world. At the same time, he recognized that having a World Trade Center here in Salt Lake City and covering the entire state would help provide a resource and a one-stop shop for Utah companies to be able to come and learn how they could identify international opportunities, develop strategies to take advantage of them, and then have partners in helping those companies here in the state execute on that strategy. And so he worked with the Governor's Office of Economic Development, the Salt Lake Chamber, other key community partners to set up a World Trade Center here in the state. And at the outset, the World Trade Center Utah worked very, very closely with the governor's office, and that legacy has continued through the years. And so just for your listeners may not be aware, but there are 330 World Trade Centers around the world. There are 90 different countries, and the mission of the World Trade Center Association is to make doing business around the world easy.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, that's not the gotcha cutoff that you use to get from the top of the mountain down at the end of the day. Hopefully, we'll get him back. Let's run to a – can we do a PSA while we're
that's
waiting?
That's a great suggestion.
Okay. We'll be right back with our guest, Miles.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Miles, we've got you back on the line. Thanks for coming back.
Great. I apologize about that.
No worries. You were just going through – I think you just completed talking about the number of World Trade Centers around the world and their mission. Can you pick up from there?
Yep, exactly. So we, just like I was mentioning, when a company is ready to go, we have this great network of partners around the world, like I mentioned, in 90 different countries. We also work very closely with the U.S. Commercial Service, and they have people, you know, boots on the ground around the world. And so we can leverage that network to open doors and generate momentum for Utah companies as they're out there trying to compete and win around the world.
Can you do you have an anecdote about a particular company and how this you were able to help them and how it worked?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's take ACT Aerospace, a phenomenal company in Gunnison, Utah. They make a composite parts for a variety of industries, including the aerospace and defense industry. And so we've been with ACT Aerospace in Dubai to help them make some connections there. I was with ACT Aerospace in Tokyo, and we were able to get them a meeting with senior people for Mitsubishi, which is a large aerospace and defense company, among many other things. And first in that meeting, you know, we were there to help ACT Aerospace make some connections. They'd identified Japan as a key opportunity, and Mitsubishi is developing a new jet, a new commercial jet. And so what we realized was that this would be a great match. And so we sat there in the meeting, and we had provided some grant funding to help ACT Aerospace get there to Japan. We had arranged for the meeting. And then in that meeting, you know, I was able to be there to help Mitsubishi recognize ACT Aerospace as a phenomenal company that's doing great things here in the state of Utah and around the world. And being there help provide some third-party validation for ACT Aerospace so they can hear on behalf of World Trade Center Utah why we're so excited about ACT Aerospace and why Mitsubishi should do business with ACT Aerospace. And it was interesting because at the outset of the meeting, Mitsubishi said, no, we're covered. We've got our supply chains. You know, we're not really looking to expand and diversify who we're sourcing from in the United States. But by the end of the meeting, they said, you know what? What you're doing is unique. And they made arrangements to go from Tokyo to Gunnison, Utah. They made a couple of trips out following up from our trip and ended up signing contracts with ACT Aerospace. And now ACT is doing work for Mitsubishi, which is one of the great corporations in the world. And so that's just one example of many where we're able to plug in and provide this type of support to Utah companies to help them grow and help create jobs and prosperity here in the state.
So with that example, are you working with then the World Trade Center in Japan to help put those relationships together? Or is that something that you have relationships with the connections at the World Trade Center Utah to be able to make those calls and set up that meeting?
Allison, that's a great, great question. In that particular case, we'd worked with the U.S. Commercial Service through the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo to line up that meeting. That's interesting because what it demonstrates is every country is a little bit different. Every company is a little bit different. And so what we do is we encourage companies that are looking to grow internationally to reach out to us. And whether or not, like I mentioned, they don't know for sure which markets to grow into, or maybe they say, you know what, we want to focus on aerospace in France, we then can go and wherever they are in that pipeline, we can find ways to plug in and support. And if it's time to make those introductions internationally, you know, every country, every industry is a little bit different, and we'll work with all of our partners to go out there and help them connect with the people that they need to connect with in those markets.
You mentioned that you were able to provide a grant to get those people to Tokyo in that first example. Tell us a little bit about how you are funded. Where does the money come from and who do you get it from?
Yep, that's a great question. So we have a variety of funding sources. We receive support from the state of Utah, from the legislature, and from the governor's Office of Economic Development, which enables us to provide these services to any company here in the state. We also receive some support as we manage a grant program for the Small Business Administration, the federal agency that is whose mission is to help support small businesses. And that grant is called the STEP, or the State Trade Expansion Program Grant Program. And I'll talk a bit about that more here in a second. But the bulk of our funding comes from private companies here in the state. And so we're a membership organization, so companies pay membership dues, and typically it's companies who believe in our mission and recognize that as we help internationalize Utah's economy, that's good for all different types of businesses here in the state. And it's also companies that pay fees for some of our more in-depth services when we're out there helping companies grow. I mentioned the grant program, and this is critical for your listeners, for any companies that may be tuning in this morning. These grant programs help provide some support to small and medium-sized companies to help them grow. And some people ask, well, why is the federal government interested in this, and why should we be providing these grants? And the reason is that companies that grow internationally, they create more jobs, they grow quicker, they create jobs quicker, those jobs are higher paying, and they're far more resilient. And so there's tremendous public good that comes as companies grow internationally. And so if a company is interested, they can go to our website, WTCUtah.com. On there, they can go to a page on grants, and they can learn more about the eligibility for the grant program. They can apply for those grants, and there's a lot of flexibility on what they can do with the grant funding. Everything from internationalizing and optimizing their website to paying for certifications and regulatory issues to break into a new market, to pay for market research, paying for flights, hotels, travel, those types of things. And so we work hard to make it a very seamless process, to have very low administrative costs with managing the grant funding, because we want to provide those grants to companies to help them, to help turbocharge their growth and to help them go out there and reap the benefits of engaging internationally.
When we started the conversation, I had given the history of when the World Trade Center Utah was created, and as you explained, it was created underneath Governor Huntsman when he was governor. But since that time, he's had, you know, more experience in the international realm, and he is also the new board chairman and was recently appointed. So John Huntsman Jr. is now, again, the board chairman of World Trade Center Utah. How will his past experience assist with this growth?
Yeah, Ambassador Huntsman has come full circle, and it's been exciting to see that happen. You know, first I want to note that when then-Governor Huntsman set up World Trade Center Utah in 2007, Scott Anderson, who is also the president, CEO and president of Zions Bank, he served as chair. And so he was chair of World Trade Center Utah for 12 years, and he did more than any other individual to grow up the organization and position us to be this accelerant for growth for Utah companies. Late last year, he is now, Scott Anderson is now the chair of the American Bankers Association. And that's a big deal. It is a big deal for Zions. It's a big deal for the state. The American Bankers Association is a premier association for the financial industry with a lot of influence back in Washington, D.C. And so Scott had to focus on that. So we knew that we had to find a new chair for the organization, and John Huntsman is always looking for opportunities to serve, and so he was willing to come on and serve as chairman of the board. And we have a phenomenal board of directors of key business leaders across the state. And so having Huntsman come back at this juncture is phenomenal because, as you pointed out, Allison, he's got tremendous international experience. I joke that you couldn't genetically engineer somebody better positioned to come in and be chair of World Trade Center Utah, because John Huntsman has diplomatic experience serving as U.S. ambassador to Singapore, China, and Russia. He has international business experience as he worked in the Huntsman Corporation to help that company grow around the world. And then, of course, he's got statewide experience having served as governor. And so in his role, he is able to advise and mentor me as I work with the World Trade Center Utah team. He is a phenomenal leader for our board of directors as they work to provide oversight and guidance to the organization. And he's just a tremendous resource. As I was talking to him about coming on board, he made it clear that he had no interest in being a show horse. And I said, John, that's fantastic because I don't need a show horse. I need a workhorse. Mm. I need somebody who's willing to roll up their sleeves to help Utah companies grow. And that is exactly what he's committed to do.
So, Miles, one of the things about doing this show during this past year has been we can't seem to get through an interview without the word pandemic coming up. So yep. I wanted to sort of touch on how have you seen the impact of the pandemic on international business for Utah companies over the last year?
You know, it's interesting. There was that moment about a year ago, and we all remember it. There was a 4 to 6 week window where I think for every organization here in the state and around the world, it was all hands on deck. Everybody adapting to working virtually, trying to figure out what the pandemic meant for business. And what that meant was, you know, varied significantly across different types of organizations and companies and industries. But I'll tell you, by about the end of April, we started to notice here in the state of Utah that because our economy was doing relatively better than just about any other state in many other countries around the world, many of our companies had their sea legs underneath them during the pandemic, and they were eager to go out there into the world to try to find ways to grow their market share amidst the significant economic and market disruption that was happening all around the world. And so starting in late April, we pivoted a lot of our programming that used to be in person, where we would do, you know, trade missions. For instance, we were planning to take 70 Utah companies to the Middle East in April in person before the pandemic, and of course the pandemic squandered those plans, but we pivoted to a virtual trade mission. And we ended up having 250 Utah companies connecting with counterparts in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to engage virtually. And that transition happened very quickly, and then the pace accelerated. And we have been busier the past 9 months as an organization than we ever have been, because so many Utah companies are doing okay, and they're out there working hard to find opportunities to grow, not just here in Utah or across the United States, but all around the world.
Miles, I guess I had gotten the impression over time that traditionally it was really important to do in-person meetings to do international business. And with some cultures in particular, there were rituals that had to be gone through. Obviously, with the pandemic, as you've just indicated, there was a lot of virtual interaction going on.
What's your take on whether or not there will be a permanent change that as a result of the pandemic and the fact that everybody had to go virtual, that in the future you'll be able to do more international business on a virtual basis because that cultural norm may have been shifted?
You know, this in-person interaction is a key part of international business. And if we think about it, that has been a barrier in some ways because to really make progress on a deal, you had to fly wherever it was in the world that you were doing business with and be there in person. And you're absolutely correct in that these virtual tools that existed before the pandemic, but we've all become very good at utilizing because of the pandemic, those are going to lower the barrier to growing internationally. And I still believe that person-to-person interaction is going to be important. Lou Kramer, who was the first CEO of World Trade Center Utah, always says that the most important distance in international business is the last 3 feet, that person-to-person interaction. And I think that will continue to be true. But the difference is that by the time a company gets on an airplane to fly, to meet face-to-face with somebody, to work on a deal, they will have had 5 or 6 or 7 meaningful interactions via Zoom or Google or Microsoft Teams, whatever they're utilizing. And so I do think that you're going to see a lot more business happening virtually to tee things up. So then by the time you get there in person, you're ready to sign deals and you're there consummating, you know, whatever the next opportunity is. And I contrast that with prior to the pandemic, where you'd fly out there to start building the relationship or start doing some due diligence. But now people can do that from here in the state. And I think that will have a long-lasting and a significant impact on the way that we do business internationally.
Miles, before you go, I wanted to get a better sense of kind of where Utah sits with other states. And that's, you know, I had mentioned that, you know, in 2015, World Trade Center Utah had helped Utah do $13 billion worth of business. But how does Utah compare with other states on the area of international exports?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have one of the most international economies in the United States. So here in the state of Utah, nearly 1 in 4 jobs are tied to international trade. And that's, since we're a small business state, that's primarily done by small businesses. 85% of Utah exporters are small businesses, and they're spread out, about 3,500 companies spread out across 30 different industries. And in terms of how we compare with other states, over the past few years, Utah has led the nation in our export growth rate. Here in the state of Utah, international sales added about $5 billion in revenue to small businesses. And that is, in the Western United States, that puts us about third behind California and Washington, who obviously have much larger economies and many more businesses. And so we are highly international, and if you were to take that down and make it, you know, per capita based on the size of our GDP, then that would put us just about the top in the nation in terms of the international sales that are going to small businesses. And I think the reason for this is we have this international culture here. We speak 130 languages here in the state of Utah, which is more than any other place in the United States, if not the world. 20% of the Mandarin immersion taught across the United States is taught here in the state of Utah, and through our wonderful dual immersion school programs. And so we have this very international culture, and so you see companies much earlier in their lifespan looking to grow internationally. And all this means good news for the state of Utah, because like I mentioned before, the greater extent to which our economy is internationalized, the more resilient we are and the faster we grow. And that's good during good times, and as we've seen over the past year, it's particularly good during bad times. And we see this economic resilience that is pushing us forward as a state right now, despite the pandemic. And a lot of that can be attributed to the fact that our economy is so international in nature.
We've been talking to Miles Hansen, the CEO of the World Trade Center Utah, who brought us some pretty good news. Miles, thanks for spending time with us. Mountain Money will be right back after this.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Located on Snow Creek Drive, Beauty Zone has been a full-service salon in Park City for 25 years. Joining us to talk about its success is second-generation owner, Micah Taylor. Micah, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you.
So tell us about the start of Beauty Zone and how your family has been a part of it for the full 25 years.
Yeah, so I mean, I think owning a business like Beauty Zone was kind of inevitable. The beauty industry runs in my family pretty heavily. I myself am fourth generation makeup artist in the film industry, and I have many other family members that own businesses like Beauty Zone. So when we moved to Utah, my mother just absolutely loved Park City, and she knew right off the bat she wanted to have her business in Park City. I officially started working at Beauty Zone at 15 years old as a front desk staff member. unofficially, when I was much younger, when I didn't have a babysitter or a school, my mother would bring me to work and I'd be a cleaning machine.
So, Micah, as someone who does not have extensive experience in the beauty industry, tell us a little bit about what a full-service salon does.
Yeah, so we offer multiple services, a large array. From basically head to toe, we offer hair services, we offer nail services, we are a natural nail salon, and then we also offer waxings and facials.
A natural nail salon means?
We don't do any acrylics. We don't use anything that involves any harsh chemicals. So we mostly just deal with just natural nails only.
Again, as I mentioned to our last guest, I can't seem to do an interview this year without using the word pandemic. I would have thought that given the person-to-person contact elements of a beauty salon, that would have been a particularly tricky thing for you to navigate. Talk to us a little bit about how you approached the last year in terms of that.
Yeah, it's definitely been very different trying to navigate through COVID, really. I mean, it is impossible to social distance. We are physically touching people. But I'm happy to say that we have not had any COVID spread in our salon, and I really attribute that to our strict protocols and our staff members who do a really great job upholding that and really just take it seriously even in their own personal lives. And so I really think that by making sure that we keep up with those protocols, even after masks might go away in April, but you know, to be honest, we probably will keep them going in our salon. I think that's been a really huge attribute to keeping everyone safe.
How long did you have to shut down for, and you know, how were you able to bring it back?
We were shut down for about a month. To be honest, if it wasn't for the support of our community and the locals, and not even just during COVID, but just throughout the years, we would not be in business. It is 100% the support of the community.
And, you know, being here for 25 years, you've become a staple in the Snow Creek Plaza. I believe you were one of the first tenants because that opened back in like 95, 96.
And you've 96, yes.
Yeah, outlasted many other businesses who began there. What's the secret to your success? And I suppose, you know, as you just said right now, locals.
You know, I really think that it's the fact that me, my mother, and our staff members over the years genuinely care about our clients and our customers and our community. Being in the salon setting, there are certain types. I just feel like we get to know people on just such a personal level that really, I've known a lot of these clients and a lot of these customers for 20 years plus, and I feel like they're like my family. It really is because of the locals in our community that we've been able to stay in business for as long as we have.
Like any business, I'm sure you see interesting things from time to time. Do you have a favorite story of something that you would tell to people and say, you're not going to believe what happened today at the salon?
Yeah. I've got a couple. One of them was, besides having the pleasure of having Will Smith and his family come into our store whenever they visit Beauty Zone, we are a beauty supply store along with a hair salon. So they'll come in and get their supplies when they're in town. So that's always really fun for my staff members to experience. But also one really big thing that I feel like has been such an impact in my life is, even though it wasn't directly my experience, it was more my mother's experience. A customer came into the store looking for some hair color to do her own hair and some nail supplies to do her own nails. And so she was helping her with, you know, picking out some products and some different tools and giving her some tips and tricks, brought her to the manicure table to kind of show her how to use things. And I wasn't there for a lot of the conversation. I just kind of assumed it was just her, you know, my mother telling her, you know, how to use the things that she was recommending. And the very next day, this woman came in tears with a bouquet of flowers and just told my mother that she had changed her life. Apparently, she had lost her husband and her son and her brother all in the same year. And it kind of was a really amazing thing to witness. Especially at such a young age when you're kind of trying to figure things out, what you want to do in the future. And that was kind of a turning point for me as far as this is what I want to do. This is the business I want to be in. That's the kind of thing I want to do with people. I want to be able to help people in a different, unconventional way.
And that's a great story to be able to just, you know, again, show the connection that you make with the clients. Kind of the last question we've got for you before we wrap up is, you know, what are your hopes for the future?
Yes. I mean, I feel like my hopes have kind of shifted a little bit since COVID, being as that, you know, obviously we can't book to capacity and, you know, we don't offer certain services that require removal of masks. I cannot wait to stop holding ourselves back. I want to be able to, you know, keep growing as a business and really see what we can do. As a business and just keep growing, really. I just want to stop holding ourselves back as a business.
No, I think we're all ready for that in our own lives as well. Micah, thank you for joining us. We've been speaking with owner of Beauty Zone, Micah Taylor, about their 25th anniversary. You've been listening to Mountain Money. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. I want to thank our sponsors. We could not do a show like this without them. Jan's Mountain Outfitters, First Community Bank, Columbus Pacific Development with Pendry Residences, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, and San Francisco Design.
And I'd like to thank our guests today. I had a wonderful time with the interviews. We spoke with Jasmine Gard about the end of slavery and how it led to two different minimum wages. Miles Hansen with the World Trade Center Utah and Micah Taylor with Beauty Zone.
You know, over the next few weeks, we like to take on controversial financial topics at Mountain Money, and we also like to present multiple sides. So we'll be hearing from we hope to be hearing from a fairly conservative author on the minimum wage in the next couple of weeks. If you have suggestions for us, send them to us, mountainmoney@kpcw.org. You've been listening to KPCW Park City, Mountain Money. Thank you for spending time with us. NPR News is next.
You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.